Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning, Wits, The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, how is spring springing across the state this year? And what role does government have in trying to make us happy? But first, tax day is 1 week from today, which means lots of taxpayers and accountants are busy getting filings ready. But some residents, especially those on the political left, have been talking about maybe not paying their taxes this year as a kind of protest against the Trump administration. These kinds of protests are not confined to the left, though. The Tea Party movement went through similar discussions earlier in this century. With me now to talk more about all this is Adam Chodorow, tax professor at ASU's Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Adam, good morning.
Good morning.
So let's talk a little bit about the history of this, because as I mentioned, the left is not, this is not something that only the left deals with. Like, the Tea Party was kind of predicated on not wanting to pay more taxes, right?
Right. They weren't withholding their taxes, but they were protesting the taxes that existed and wanted lower taxes.
And what are you seeing? I mean, are you hearing rumblings of people on the left saying, yeah, maybe this year I'm not going to. Maybe I'm going to, like, you know, give a rhetorical middle finger to the federal government this year?
Yeah, actually, it's more than rhetorical. It would be a true middle finger. But yes, there are some rumblings on the left about, you know, maybe the thing to do is not pay your taxes. This actually came up the last time Trump was in office in 2017, there was a lot of talk about tax protests, and it's sort of bubbling up again as sort of things get chaotic.
Okay, so you say it's more than rhetorical. I mean, for one thing, it's not legal to not pay your taxes, right?
Yeah, it is not legal at all, and you could be subject to both civil and criminal penalties for failing to pay your taxes.
Now, what about the idea that, you know, which I assume that you have heard, I've read online as well. Well, you know, they're defunding the IRS. Like, they're not gonna even have any agents to come after me, to audit me, or to ask me to pay my taxes if I don't do it.
Right. So one of the potential traps is people thinking, well, with the IRS getting wiped out, who's gonna figure it out? Well, the problem is that most of us get W-2s, which report our wages to the government, and 1099s, which report our interest, our dividends. Mm-hmm. Et cetera. And so the government actually has most of our information. So if we fail to pay, it's actually fully automated. So the computer just says, wait a minute, we got this 1099. You didn't report it. We're coming after you. You get an automatically generated letter saying you failed to pay your taxes.
Regardless of whether or not there are X number of agents still working at the IRS.
That's right.
So you also, you wrote a piece in Slate, an online magazine, about some of the other sort of like moral, ethical questions about whether or not one should pay their taxes. And you made the argument that for those on the left, not paying their taxes might not have the sort of the political impact they hope it would have.
Right. I mean, there's the practical question, which is, if I withhold my taxes, what am I doing? I'm depriving the government of money. When you're protesting some government policy like the war in Vietnam, you know, that makes a little sense. But right now, what the Trump administration wants to do is cut government spending. And what better excuse can you imagine to cut government spending than the fact that, well, people haven't been paying their taxes, so we don't have the money, so we're going to have to fire more workers, cut more grants, et cetera, et cetera.
There's also the issue, and this is a conversation that I think a lot of people have, is like, wouldn't it be nice if we could say, okay, I have to pay, let's say, $100 in taxes. I want $20 to go to this. I want $20 to go to that. I want $50 to go to that. That's not how it works, right? Like, you pay your taxes to the state or the federal government, and they use the money the way that they want, not just going to causes or programs that we like.
Right. So we are a democracy, which means that the majority gets to decide what we fund and how much we fund it at. There's one small area where you kind of can get to direct where your tax money goes, and that's charitable contributions.
Mm-hmm.
Functionally, what you're doing when you give money to charities, you're giving your money and then the tax money that you would have paid to the charity. But aside from that very small limitation, generally speaking, the government gets to decide, and the government decides based on whoever it is we elect.
So in that sense, then, I mean, one could, I would imagine, also make the argument that you know, if you don't pay your taxes, it just could mean the programs that you actually do like that the federal government does will be the ones that have to go away because they don't have the money.
Exactly. It seems to me, for instance, unlikely that the Trump administration would say, look, we collected less than we expected. So what we're going to do is we're going to cut defense. We're going to cut the things that people on the left tend not to care about or tend to care about less or think could be made more efficient. Instead, what they're going to say is, all right, well, now all foreign aid is gone, to the extent it's not already gone, and other programs that people on the left care about, they're going to be gone too.
Do you have a sense of, like, how big of a contingent of, I guess this year we'd have to call them non-taxpayers, there might be? Like, do you think a lot of people are going to do this?
I don't think so, and I hope not, because the penalties for failing to pay your taxes are incredibly steep. There is a failure to file penalty. There is a failure to pay penalty. And then interest, right? It could easily end up the case that you end up more in penalties and interest than you owed in taxes.
Well, and there's also the issue, right, that we all, many of us anyway, pay taxes every couple of weeks, right? Like when we get our paychecks. And that for a lot of people, not filing means they're not getting a refund.
Right, right. So one of the things that happens is that you have money withheld from your paycheck every time you get paid. And often, for a lot of people, they actually over-withhold. So if you don't file your taxes, you can't ask for that money back, and that's a real problem.
Do you see this as a thing that's going to just keep continuing to happen, that people who are unhappy with the federal government, whoever's in office, or maybe even the state government, whoever's in office, to try to at least talk about withholding their taxes as a form of protest? Or do you think at some point people are going to realize maybe this isn't the best way to register our unhappiness?
I think that people are going to talk about it forever, right? Every time the government does something you don't like, people are going to have this instinct of, oh, yeah, well, then I won't pay my taxes. Do I think it's going to actually turn into a widespread movement? I doubt it because of the consequences, right? It turns out you have the right to protest, but you also have to suffer the consequences of protesting.
Fair enough. All right. That is Adam Chodorow, tax professor at ASU Sandra Day O'Connor College of Law. Adam, thank you.
Thank you.
Back in 2023, following the events of October 7th that reignited a decades-old conflict in Gaza, Phoenix artist Joan Baron started a project she calls Tiny Prayer Space. It's a participatory exhibition. Baron invites visitors to her workspace to join her in sitting on the floor, making tiny clay beads for each life lost in the war, Palestinian, Israeli, and aid workers alike. So far, she and her guests/collaborators have made more than 45,000 beads. Baron recently spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman about the origins of the project, which continues to this day.
I had a very strong inclination to speak to it through my artistic practice, and I had to figure out what was it going to look like.
Once you decided that you wanted to figure out a way to speak to this conflict through your artistic practice, how did you happen upon bead making specifically? How did that come to you in your thought process?
So I was looking for something that we all had in common through our history. And the bead making came up. And I thought, okay, my practice focuses on working with earth materials, clay. The bead was like so clear to me that that would be the form in which I would express my concerns.
What was it about beads specifically?
It was something that was used in so many different ways within meditation practices. It was also a means of body adornment. As a ritual, you would wear beads during ceremony. Love was a huge component in the evolution of choosing the beads, because you don't make beads to express anger. You make beads to express love in some form or another. So it became
That's
strong...
That's true. I've never really heard of an anger bead.
Right? Yeah. So it was also a way to make people comfortable for coming to Tiny Prayer Space, which is a separate little room that I embellished with rugs and pillows and welcome people to come and sit with me on the floor, on the pillows, in a grounded way.
It's interesting to me that you had this instinctive reaction of wanting to connect with love, of wanting to ground people, of wanting to make these objects that you associate with these warm feelings. Because I know I don't have to tell you, this conflict has generated such intense partisan feeling. And it would also make sense to me if you as an artist were to say, I feel compelled by what's happening here to make art that is in support of the Palestinian cause or in support of the Israeli cause. But you have made a different choice.
The idea of looking at a life lost in this conflict was more significant to me than taking sides. And I really wanted to address that. Where is the value of a life? And if we think about it in those terms, we can't take sides.
Can I ask you about the prayer component of that, though? Mm. Because what you're expressing there is not necessarily spiritual, but the idea of spirituality is encoded directly into the name of this project. It's Tiny Prayer Space.
Correct. So the incorporation of prayer has to do with an incident that happened to me when I was very young. I was with my brothers and cousins, and we were playing in Lake Erie, and we would jump off my uncle's little boat. He had anchored it in the sandbar, so when we would jump, we would hit the sandbar no deeper than our knees, and we would do this for hours, climb back up the little ladder, jump off the boat, and just have a great time. One of those jumps, I did not hit the sandbar. I remember the feeling, like I'm sitting here today with you. I remember the feeling I'm drowning, and I was moving my arms. I remember how cold the water was, because the deeper you are in water, right, it gets colder.
So just to make sure I understand, that you jump in a way that you've jumped a bunch of times before, but instead of the sandbar stopping your fall, you just keep falling deeper into the water.
So what was happening was the anchor had allowed the boat to drift beyond where the sandbar ended. So the next thing I remember were hands lifting me up out of the water and carrying me to shore. When I asked my family, my cousins, did you see what happened, or did you see anybody carrying me to shore? And nobody saw anything. However, when we got home, one of our dear family friends, who happened to be a minister at a small church nearby, asked, did anything happen to one of you barren kids over the weekend at the lake? And said, why? Why did you ask? And she said, well, I was in the middle of preaching, and this overwhelming feeling of concern came over me, and I asked my congregation if we could pause and pray for the barren children.
Right around the time when you're—
The same day. It was a Sunday.
Hold on. Wait. I have to ask you a couple follow-up questions here. So that's a remarkable story. So when you asked your—it was your uncle's boat?
Yes.
When you asked your uncle and your brothers, that it wasn't that they had jumped in after you?
No.
So from everybody's standpoint, Joan jumped, Joan was underwater, and the next thing they knew, you were on the shore.
Yeah. So the power of prayer entered my life and became
ostensibly
literally part of my DNA.
In the congregation were praying for you.
Yes.
Right around the time that you were somehow saved.
Yes. Pretty intense.
That's a powerful experience.
Yeah.
That's a powerful experience.
Yeah. As a result of that childhood experience, I was compelled to try to understand more about prayer. And if I can use my art in a way to continue to deliver the message of love, then I feel I have taken on a piece of that responsibility that I was told that I must take on when I was a very young person.
So you have brought in some of the beads here. We have them here in the studio, and I'm looking at them.
If you were to lift in your hand several of those, they make a beautiful sound.
I'll do that.
Yes.
I'm being careful because I don't want to break any of
them.
Yeah,
you won't. Yeah. Right? So it could be the sound of the shofar. It could be the sound
of the
sheep.
This one looks like a little shofar.
Yeah. It could be the sound of the sheep. And so many symbols and shapes came up for people. There are not any two beads alike, just like there are not two human beings alike. I feel like Tiny Prayer Space is an extension of me, so I refer to it as a living being.
Mm-hmm.
The very act of setting up an environment where you feel comfortable and safe will allow you to then express your concerns, your fears, talk about the trauma that you have experienced as a result of this conflict. And how might we create sacred space together?
Well, Joan Baron is an interdisciplinary artist here in Phoenix, and we've been discussing her project, Tiny Prayer Space. Joan, thank you for this conversation.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, has spring really sprung at all? An environmental scientist explains what a relatively dry winter could mean for our desert ecosystem. But first, how happy are we? There are lots of ways to measure that, although it's not always a simple question to answer. And the idea of happiness and what makes us happy can also vary a lot from person to person. The World Happiness Index aims to get a sense of it using metrics including healthy life expectancy, generosity, and positive and negative emotions. The most recent report, which takes in data averaged between 2022 and 2024, finds Finland as the happiest country on Earth, followed by Denmark, Iceland, and Sweden. The U.S. is ranked 24th, just behind the U.K. and just ahead of Belize. That's the lowest we've ever ranked in the report's more than decade-long history. So clearly, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to happiness.
Happy, baby?
I'm so happy.
Happy!
Happy.
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 Do you ever wish that you could just be happier?
I didn't really believe in happiness. I thought that only idiots were happy.
Happiness is not something you find outside of yourself, and it's not something you have or don't have.
I hope you're happy. I hope you're happy now.
Your happiness is enjoyment, satisfaction, and purpose.
Over the next 3 days, we'll be looking at the issue of happiness and how we impact it. And we start with Anthony Rendon, Speaker Emeritus of the California Assembly. A few years back, he decided to try to find out what role government has in people's happiness. The result was a first-of-its-kind legislative committee to consider happiness as a policy issue. The result of that was a report looking at how policymakers in California can have an impact on making residents there happy or unhappy. But can government actually legislate happiness? And wouldn't laws that make some people happy also make other people unhappy? I spoke with Rendon earlier and asked what led him to create this committee in the first place.
Well, I've always been interested in really sort of, you know, fundamental questions. I studied philosophy in school. It's what I got my PhD in. So questions of justice, questions of beauty, questions of truth, knowledge. You know, those have always been the things that interest me. It occurred to me, particularly after watching and seeing a little bit of the academic work that we in politics, but particularly here in California, we never really talk much about happiness, which is the only reason, you know, we should be in this job is to make sure people are happy. It's the only reason, you know, most of us should probably wake up in the morning. And I thought it was something that, you know, how can you possibly want to make people's lives better if you're not thinking about what makes them happy?
It's interesting to hear you say that the main job of an elected official is to make people happy. I'm guessing that is not something that you are hearing from a lot of your colleagues.
Well, I think I should back up. I think the main job of of government should be to create conditions in which people can, you know, live lives that are happy. I don't think it's a job of the government necessarily to make people happy, but I think, it, you know, in terms of making, creating conditions, whether, you know, they're relating to housing, whether relating to healthcare, those types of things, I think that's what we do. I think that's what we should do.
So, like, in your mind, what actually is the role of government in creating happiness? Like, what should the government do? What can the government do?
Well, I think we should first back up. And the point of this select committee was always to ask fundamental questions about happiness. What makes people happy? If government can accomplish some of those things, great. If it's not the role of government, if it's strictly tied to family, then that means the answer is no. Government has no role in it. So initially, my goal was to start asking questions about what makes people happy, regardless of whether or not those things have anything to do with government. If there's no role for government, that's fine. Then we scratch that off the list, and we know that that's not our role. But during the hearings, we talked a lot about people know that, you know, having opportunities for for shared space is really important, and that's why obviously parks and urban planning is important. We discovered that intergenerational connections are so incredibly important, particularly to older folks, and having those ties to younger folks. So, I mean, it's looking at those fundamental aspects of happiness and to see whether or not government has a role in them or not.
What surprised you with what people told you when you started asking these questions?
I think what surprised me is the extent to which people hadn't asked the questions before or hadn't even thought about it. And I think that's sad. I think that says a lot about our society. I think it says a lot about our lack of introspection as, you know, as a society and as individuals. More than anything, that was stunning to me.
So what did you do with the results, or what do you hope that future legislatures in California, now that these questions have been asked and people have answered them, like, what kinds of policies would you expect to see coming out of the California legislature to address some of these issues?
I think opportunities for more sort of, you know, communal spaces in our society. That seems to be so important. Isolation is a huge problem, particularly with social media and COVID happening quite recently. Having opportunities for social interaction is very important, whether those are tied into, you know, our physical space, or whether those are sort of opportunities, you know, the way we sort of construct work, the way we construct our schools are important. Another thing that's very important to people is, you know, free time and how they invest that free time. And I think we can look at ways of making, of allowing in the workplace allowing more opportunities for that as well.
In listening to some of those policy areas, it strikes me that these are not like the hot button controversial issues that you see a lot of politicians yelling at each other about, either on the floors of legislative chambers or on cable news. Like, these are almost more basic than that. Is that a fair assessment, do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, these are, you know, I've always been interested, again, in things that are really fundamental. And I think when, you know, a lot of that stuff, to a large extent, I think seems like a distraction to people. It's easy politics. It's easy to preach to the choir. It's easy to preach to your constituents because you already know what they think about some of those issues. But this is something that, you know, that people, at least in the United States, haven't been asking. A lot of places have been looking at these questions in the past, whether it's academically at Oxford. Nepal has a way of measuring their gross national happiness. So it seems like countries and places all over the world have been looking at this, but not really in the U.S., and I think we need to.
It's interesting because I think if you ask a lot of people, not just in California, but pretty much anywhere, like, sort of a basic question, do politics make you happy? I'm guessing that a lot of people would say, no, they don't. And it's just sort of an interesting idea that, as you're saying, like, this is sort of the fundamental question that policy should be asking. Like, are we doing what we can to let people live good lives, to let them sort of live the way they want to live? And yet, on sort of a macro level, for a lot of people, politics is more anxiety inducing than happiness inducing.
Yeah, and I think we have constructed it that way. We've constructed the conversations that way. I'm always I was just talking to a group of students right now. I told them I've never watched a presidential debate in my life. I'm not interested in politics on that level. I don't watch MSNBC. I don't watch CNN. I don't watch Fox. Politics on that level is incredibly dull to me. It's not interesting to me. I care about the impact, the intersection between public policy and people's lives. And, you know, I think we have begun to think about politics as a sport, about who got who and who got over on who and all that kind of nonsense that, again, is not fundamental either to politics or to our own lives.
So I've got to ask, when you were serving in the legislature and you would ask people, like, what can we do to make you happy? Did anybody say, I wish you guys would all just go away?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's a fair answer. I think some people want to be left alone, and that's an important part of the conversation. So, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, a lot of people want to be left alone. A lot of people want to be left alone by government. And that's totally fair. That has to be part of the data.
Do you foresee this becoming more of a topic of conversation among policymakers going forward? You mentioned that not many are doing it now. Like, do you see a time when it might be more of a topic on the agenda?
I hope so. It certainly is in terms of academia. The World Happiness Index, the World Happiness Report, which come out once a year, tends to get a lot of press. I think politics is not a place where you get quick wins. These, again, are fundamental philosophical questions. Doesn't mean they're not data driven. And for me, that was ultimately what I wanted to do. This, I never wanted this to be some sort of new agey weird thing, right? I wanted this to be data driven. And there's 25 years of data just strictly from the World Happiness Index, World Happiness Report, which started at the UN, has now been taken over by Oxford. So there's a lot of hard data on this. And for me, you know, it's important that we focus on that.
That is Anthony Rendon, the Speaker Emeritus of the California Assembly. Thank you so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
A new technology to enhance the basketball experience for spectators who are blind or have low vision has been getting a lot of attention recently. The show's Amber Victoria Singer went to a Phoenix Suns game recently to learn more about the tactile device and other accommodations for people with disabilities at PHX Arena.
Marcus Ramirez has been a Suns fan for over a decade. He went to his first game in eighth grade.
I remember that game like it was just like yesterday. As a young kid, I think that was like the most adrenaline I had run through me really fast.
Ramirez lost his sight 4 years ago from a gunshot injury. That changed the way he experiences the world in a lot of ways, including basketball. Now a recent invention is allowing fans like him to feel the game, even if they can't see the court. Earlier this year, Phoenix Suns and Ticketmaster partnered with OneCourt, a company that has created a way to make that possible, to bring the technology to Suns games. The device itself is a thick black tablet with a raised outline of a basketball court. With help from the NBA's live data, vibrations follow the ball as it moves across the court, only a split second after it does in real time. Ramirez is at tonight's game to try out the invention. As he uses it, he explains that while he feels how the ball is moving, he pictures the court in his head.
So having the vibration run through it, having it on my lap, having both of my hands on the board, I can have a really good image of how the ball's being tossed around and what kind of plays are being made.
The board comes with headphones, so users have the option to listen to an automated voice announce each play. It'll say things like shot, miss, shot, score, free throw, rebound, foul, timeout. It's not perfect. For example, users will hear the audience cheer before the automated voice confirms that the shot was a score. But Ramirez likes it more than the alternative, a radio broadcast commentary of the game.
Them describing it really doesn't have, like, their full image isn't on the court. It's mainly just the talking part.
This is not the only way the Suns are working to make games accessible. Eric Bell is the Disability Services Manager for the Phoenix Suns and PHX Arena.
So I do seating exchanges for folks that use wheelchairs or have difficulty navigating stairs. I coordinate sign language interpreters for concerts and comedy shows. I schedule captioning for all of our events.
For arena attendees with autism, Down syndrome, or other sensory needs, PHX Arena offers a quiet room and kits containing noise-canceling headphones, fidget toys, and strobe glasses.
A lot of our games and events, there's a lot of lights and lasers and fire and noise. And those are all great things to a lot of people, but it can be overwhelming for a lot of people as well.
The kits also include a double-sided emotional cue card for people who may have trouble verbalizing their feelings or needs.
They say things like angry or frustrated, confused or nervous, happy and calm, or sad and tired. It also has a list of the contents of a sensory bag so that folks can either point to what they're looking for or what they're missing.
Bell says making the live sports experience accessible to as many people as possible takes time.
I think a good example is this one-court device where we just wait for the technology to catch up to not only the need, but the demographics as well.
Antish Bellini is the COO and co-founder of OneCourt. He agrees.
There's a reason why OneCourt hasn't existed for 20 years. It's because a lot of the technology that powers our technology didn't exist before.
It all comes down to the live data. In 2023, the NBA started using 3D optical tracking technology that uses cameras and sensors to track each player and the ball as the game moves across the court. The real-time information allows OneCourt to translate the game to vibrations at someone's fingertips.
These systems were originally implemented for things like officiating or for sports betting or analytics and player health and training. And we found a completely new use case for it. We have visual broadcasts, we have audio broadcasts, and now we have a tactile broadcast powered by these emerging technologies.
OneCourt collaborated with people who are blind or have low vision throughout the development, testing, and rollout of its devices.
We really like to say that we aren't designing for blind and low vision fans. We are designing with them. I think it's so important that we have representation from the community and their input along every part of the business.
OneCourt was founded in 2021. The company has tested its tactile devices with tennis, football, and baseball games. And Bellini has high hopes for the technology's future.
We believe at some point it'll be everywhere. Like you can go to maybe your kid's little league game or go to a high school soccer game and they'll have tracking data that could power experiences like this.
For basketball fans like Marcus Ramirez, the device is a game changer.
It's really interesting. With all the vibration and everything being played out, I can image what's going on.
For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Amber Victoria Singer.
There are 10 OneCourt devices available for use at Phoenix Suns games, and reservations can be made on the PHX Arena website. You can find more information about the arena's accessibility resources on their website as well. Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. With the recent passing of actor Val Kilmer, many of his fans have been sharing remembrances online about their personal relationship to Kilmer and his characters. For writer Justin St. Germain, who grew up in Tombstone, that relationship began with Kilmer's performance as Doc Holliday in the 1993 film Tombstone. St. Germain spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman about what made Kilmer so special.
It's this great thing about Val Kilmer. When he is a supporting actor, he often just kind of steals the whole movie.
Yeah.
And so he has kind of all the best lines in that movie.
Well, I suppose I'm deranged, but I guess I'll just have to call. Cover your ears, darling. Isn't that a daisy?
He's just so like charming and memorable. Ever since the first moment I saw it, you know, I had even by 12 years old, I had heard plenty about Doc Holliday. And I have never been able to think of Doc Holliday without thinking of Val Kilmer ever since. And I feel like that's a real measure of a performance, you know?
Yeah. Do you think there was anything about the real life character of Doc Holliday that you had heard at that age and something in Kilmer's performance that aligned for you?
I think most of what I remember about the stories, at least, that they tell about Doc Holliday, which, you know, obviously, I don't know how close they are to the historical factual person, but he was kind of this embodiment of like friendship and loyalty. You know, he was just Wyatt's best friend who followed him, you know, into the gunfight and kind of all over the place. And I think he really did embody that in the movie. He's just this like fiercely loyal, he's fiercely loyal to Wyatt. And that's kind of like, he's a very principled person, but that's kind of his main characteristic, is that he's just willing to kind of do anything for his friend.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine if you were 12, 13 watching a movie like that, not to, you know, put my own experience into this, but the idea of having somebody in your life at that time who was like, I got you, man, no matter what, that would have been a big deal.
Absolutely. Yeah.
There are some actors like that, right? Would you agree that, yes, they have performances that are critically acclaimed. Yes, maybe they were super bankable at the box office, and that is noteworthy for whatever reason. But some of these people, on some cellular level, we just felt like they understood us.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Val Kilmer was really the one that I wound up following and thinking about. I saw a lot of his other movies when his memoir came out. I read his memoir. A former partner bought me as a birthday gift his book of poems that he self-published in the 80s, late 80s, early 90s. Uh-huh. And so I just kind of developed this pretty strong personal connection. In my office at work, I have one of his art prints.
With some of these actors, I think, and maybe Kilmer is one, part of what you're reacting to is that even though they play a lot of different characters, and Kilmer absolutely did over the course of his career, everybody from Doc Holliday to Batman, there is something kind of essential about them that doesn't change. And maybe it's there sometimes even when they don't want it to be there, like they can't help but be themselves.
There's something about Val Kilmer where I think a lot of his best roles are these kind of haunted or doomed figures.
That's something that I remember really resonating with from his performance in Heat. You know, it's this big bravura performance from Pacino, and Robert De Niro in his way is chewing the scenery. And Kilmer is just kind of there, like really occupying this totally bonkers heist situation. I wouldn't have been able to use that word until you said it, but there is something kind of haunting or haunted about his presence there. Like it's like he's resigned to this mayhem.
Yeah, I think that's true. And just that sense of stillness and the sense of like physicality. He just has such a presence on the screen. And you're right, because when you see him, I think about Tombstone always as my first reference point. But in a lot of those moments, there's these moments where they're about to walk down to the OK Corral. And even though he is at the time in the movie very ill from tuberculosis, you know, he's sweaty. He's just crawled out of bed to try to go help his friend. He's the calm one.
It seems like with Kilmer, I mean, he's so handsome, but obviously there's a lot of inner life there. I mean, you don't self-publish a book of poems. Right. You don't write all these books. You don't make art prints unless there's really something going on internally. And I wonder if that's what accounts for the phenomenon you're describing of him being particularly memorable in these supporting roles, where it's like they're not asking him to carry the movie. They're not asking him to be the guy on the poster necessarily.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think the supporting role lets him bring maybe not quite the Nick Cage level of chaos, but right. This little bit of chaos. He seems to kind of embrace this kind of, you know, like that character, like you were saying, that character in Heat is just kind of an agent of chaos.
Right.
And so is Doc Holliday.
Heat is such a violent movie. And Kilmer, I feel like it falls to his character to really engage with the horror of how violent it is. I mean, there's this very memorable scene where he's, I forget exactly what the circumstances are, but he's like reloading this gun. And there's just this look on his face like, I have to get the shells into this weapon as quickly as possible so that I can kill more people. It's like this terrifying singularity of focus.
My brother is in law enforcement. And he told me that actually sometimes they show that clip as training, like in training for, you know, that sort of situation. Because
really,
it seems like Val Kilmer must have, Val Kilmer must have had some sort of training or took it so seriously that like he actually understood like what the military training would be for like how he's reloading, how he's kind of like using cover, his fields of fire and stuff like that.
Wow. Well, maybe in closing, Justin, if somebody has been seeing all these headlines about Val Kilmer and wants to get an appreciation of him in a movie that people don't talk about as much, what would you recommend?
I mean, really, the other one I would recommend, which I just loved, was his documentary. He had a documentary called Val, I think it was 4 or 5 years ago, and it's really thoughtful and it's really smart. He's lost his voice by then because of his throat cancer, and so mostly lost his voice. And so there's a moment I remember, he's at some sort of function where he's kind of doing like a meet and greet, and it's an Old West kind of thing. Like everybody wants to talk about Doc Holliday. And then the camera kind of captures him afterwards. He's sort of walking backstage, and he just has this moment where he is thinking, like, he says something to the effect of like, I don't know, what does it mean that I'm here trying to recapture glory from 25 years ago? You know, I'm talking about who I was 25 years ago. And he just had this really like human vulnerability. That's kind of the thing I think about recently in the days since he passed.
What do you think, darling? Should I hate him?
You don't even know him.
No, that's true, but I don't know. There's just something about him. Something around the eyes. I don't know. Reminds me of me.
Well, Justin St. Germain is a writer, the author of the memoir Son of a Gun, and as you've been hearing, is a lifelong appreciator of the work of Val Kilmer. Justin, thank you so much.
Happy to be here, Sam.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. It is spring outside, but in a few days it might not feel like it. Temperatures are forecast to hit triple digits by the end of the week. It's also been a fairly dry spring, and while that has implications for a lot of aspects of the desert ecology, today we're going to focus on phenology, that is, the study of the timing and cyclical patterns of events in the natural world. In other words, when do plants bud, when do birds come back, and when do flowers bloom? Basically, how springy is this spring? With me to answer these questions is Teresa Crimmins, Associate Professor in the School of Natural Resources and the Environment at the University of Arizona and Director of the USA National Phenology Network. And Teresa, let's start with where we are. We are now firmly into spring. So what are you seeing as far as spring springing?
It's kind of dull this year, honestly. I mean, it's finally spring. Yes, I agree with you. It has arrived. But it's not the showy spring that we've had in some recent years. We are nowhere near a super bloom. It seems like a barely bloom, honestly, in my experience. And I think that has a lot to do with how dry it has been.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you some of the reasons for that. Is it like, how much do you attribute it to the fact that, at least until somewhat recently, much of Arizona hadn't really gotten much rain?
Oh my gosh, no, we haven't. Our plants here are largely driven by moisture. And so when they don't receive adequate moisture, one of the ways that they respond is just by having a diminished bloom. You know, there are fewer flowers produced, flower buds produced, and they're slower to open. And then one of the other ways that we can really see the consequence of dry conditions are stunted growth, especially in annual plants. So a lot of those plants, when they do finally receive some moisture, will quickly germinate, but then also quickly flower and then go to seed. And so plants, grasses, and other forbs that sometimes are 6, 8, 12, 18 inches tall can flower when they're just a couple of inches tall. And I've seen that in a couple of places.
So what are the impacts of all this beyond obviously the aesthetics? Like, you know, a lot of us like to see beautiful flowers sprouting up this time of year. But if that's not happening beyond just not being able to see it, why else does that matter?
Well, a lot of insects and birds and other species like bats rely upon flowers for food sources primarily. And so when we have less of that available, it's just a little harder for them to find the resources that they need. And we can have a bit of a ripple effect, especially in those short-lived species where their population numbers can be decreased as well. Or they may have to pivot to an alternative food resource if the particular species that they prefer aren't available readily for providing nectar. Also, one good consequence, I guess you might say, is if we have fewer annual plants coming up because it's dry, homeowners might be relieved that they have fewer weeds to pull. I haven't had anything that I've needed to do in my yard this spring. And it's kind of a double-edged sword for wildfire. It's less finer fuels that might carry a fire. However, the lack of precipitation results in much drier vegetation for the plants that are out on the landscape, and so that can increase risk. So it's kind of cuts both ways there.
In terms of what we're seeing now, does that tell us anything, or is this a sign of anything to come, you know, sort of botanically or ecological wise for the next, you know, little while here?
I guess one consequence when you have fewer flowers being produced is that you have fewer seeds being produced in this particular season. But seeds are generally long-lived in the soil. They can exist years, sometimes decades, even longer. So there isn't really a huge risk from that perspective. And whether this is likely to have long-reaching changes, long-term changes, it's probably not. It's really more about probably if we keep having dry seasons one after another, that starts to really take a toll. That definitely takes a toll on all the plants. And so I don't know actually what the long range forecasts are, but I sure as heck hope we get some decent rain this monsoon because yeah, the plants are pretty dry. I see in my neighborhood the choyas are the choya cacti that usually are upright and rigid are rather droopy, and that's a sad sight to see. I see a lot of creosote that look pretty darn rough. That's a very robust a shrub that's really drought tolerant, and they can spring back. They can look terrible. And then finally, when they finally receive some rainfall, they will flush with green leaves and come back from basically what they look like are dead and fill out with flowers. So things, we haven't been pushed past any threshold, I don't think, at this point, but we could definitely benefit from seeing some moisture.
Yeah. I wonder if there's sort of a balance that you're looking for here in terms of precipitation and temperature, because I would think, you know, having a spring that is springing too early, maybe because it's warmer than average, like in January and February, and plants and flowers think, oh, it's time to go, when in fact it's really not. Like, I would think that would be a problem. But as you're saying, you know, the fact that there's very little precipitation and we're kind of having a meh bloom this year, and you know, things just aren't that exciting, maybe also isn't ideal. Like, is there really like a happy medium you're looking for here?
I think the plants just want water, honestly. So when I look at the temperatures, I'm looking at it through the lens of how plants perceive temperature. And so it's really kind of less about long-term average or, seasonal average or monthly average temperatures. It's more about how much warmth have they been exposed to, because that's usually what triggers their activity. And when we look at the rate of warmth being accumulated here in Arizona this year, it's pretty average, honestly. So I really think that we haven't had an extra warm set of conditions. I think it really has so much to do with the moisture. If we do have those really warm years and there isn't moisture, then that creates even additional stress for sure. And so if we see increasing temperatures and even just average precipitation, that can still be hard on plants. If we see increasing temperatures and less precipitation, that's definitely really, really hard on them. And there are limits. There are definitely physiological limits that we may be starting to dance with when we look at how things are trending over the long term. But I don't know that we're really flirting with that right this second.
Okay. What is the significance of tracking this kind of thing? Even as you've said, in a spring like this, a season like this, where it's not really remarkable, it's kind of a thing that's happening like it happens a lot. Why is it so important to continue to track this stuff?
Every observation that we make is a data point that can help us better construct a picture of what's happening, both across the whole landscape and among all the different species, as well as whether there's any underlying temporal trends. And so there's, we're talking in generalities right now about, how plants tend to respond to this condition and that condition, but it's a very individualistic set of conditions. Every species really responds to in different ways to different things. And largely scientists don't understand that to a great degree. And so the more information we have, the better we can disentangle that, and the better we can understand how things might be expected to change and how we might do the best job we can at facilitating their continued existence and persistence on the landscape.
All right. That is Teresa Crimmins, an associate professor at the University of Arizona School of Natural Resources and the Environment, also director of the USA National Phenology Network. Teresa, nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for being along. For Sam Dingman, I am Mark Brody in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.